This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
Welcome to DSC's Campfires with Larry Wysoon, the unique blend of hunting, fishing, wildlife conservation, and the outdoor lifestyle. DSC's Campfires is brought to you by DSC, Conservation, Education, and Hunter Advocacy. Hornady, accurate, deadly, dependable. Trigicon, brilliant aiming solutions. Taurus, award-winning pistols and revolvers. Mossberg, American built, American strong. And the Red 55 Winery in Lindale, Texas. Signature wines of Grammy award-winning country artist Miranda Lambert and owned by Rick and Beverly Lambert.
Hello.
Mr. Randy Flannery, welcome to the DSC Campfire. This is Larry Wysoon. How are you this morning?
I'm doing good, my friend. How are you?
Well, I'm probably not quite as tired as you are from all the talking that you've been doing as of late. Are you still on the road?
I certainly am. I had a busy week. I had a busy weekend. I spoke, had three seminars in a row, two in Massachusetts and one in New York State.
My gracious, Randy. I thought you were going to slow down a little bit, but, you know, hunting seasons are over, and now it's time to make a little bit more time and spend a little bit more time with people, isn't it?
It really is, and, you know, I get a little tired of the traveling sometimes, but it's a blessing, really. I have nothing to complain about.
You know what? I know you're exactly right. It's one of those things that you love to do, and during the years when I was doing a little bit more on the speaking tour, you know, I never got tired of what I did. And I know you're in the same way. You kind of get physically tired sometimes just because of the travel, all those other kind of things. You and I have talked numerous times in years past about all kinds of different things, and we've been able to share a stage of time or two in the past. And I want to visit with you a little bit about your deer hunting techniques. Now, Randy, for those of you who have, I can't imagine anybody not having heard of Randy from up in Maine, but Randy is a true hunter. You know, I kind of look at it years ago. I started out that way, then I became a shooter when I did all the TV stuff because never kind of got to hunt like I really wanted to. But Randy, you hunt the way that I think everybody needs to know how to hunt, particularly when it comes to deer. Tell me a little bit about your techniques and what kind of guns you use and all those other kind of good things.
Well, Larry, I tell people in my seminars the difference between the way my family hunts and most families hunt is we hunt the way your great-grandfather hunted and his father before him and his father before him. They couldn't afford to sit and wait for a deer to come to them. They had to put food on the table to feed their family. So that's pretty much how we hunt. And so we track and stalk, and that's pretty much what we do.
you hunt, of course, in a different situation than a lot of times that I get to do. A lot of our country is open, and yet where you're hunting, and you'll have snow, of all things. I mean, in our part of the country, if we have snow, it's like, oh, my gosh, I think all the deer kind of hide in a hole somewhere because they don't know what to do or how to do things. But your deer up there live that way, and you're in the woods. I mean, literally in the woods, aren't you, when you hunt?
Oh, yeah. We live in Washington County, Maine, which is bigger than the state of New Hampshire, and there's only 33,000 residents.
But, and it kind of starts from there, doesn't it? And let's go back. I know that you and I have talked a little bit about some of the how you actually do hunt in the past, and tracking and looking for sign and all those other kind of things. When you're out and about, let's say the hunting season has just started and there is snow on the ground, what are the first things that you look for when you get out?
Well, what I do, Larry, is just how my grandfather and my uncles taught me, mostly my grandfather, and is we ride the dirt logging roads looking for a track to take. And a good tracker should be able to tell you the difference between a buck track and a doe track in the snow and in the gravel when they're driving 10, 15 miles an hour in their truck. A good tracker should also be able to tell you within the first half mile on the track if that buck has been up chasing does all night and he wants to lay down and he's got a good chance of catching up to him, or he's going from one doe group to another and he's probably never going to catch up to him. A good tracker should also, that's just how it is. And a good tracker should also be able to tell you within the first half mile on the track, within 20, 25 pounds of what that deer weighs and what kind of headgear it has just by following the track. Reading a track is like reading a book. If you know how to track, the buck is literally telling you what it's thinking about doing.
Well, what are some of the key factors that you're looking at there? I mean, when you're looking at track, of course, you know, a Bigfoot and all that other kind of thing, but is there any particular key that you're looking for to make you want to go after an individual buck whose track that you find?
Absolutely. The size and the stride. You know, and, you know, to tell the difference between a buck and a doe track, as you are well aware of, is, you know, God made does narrower in the front and wider in the back for giving birth. And God made bucks wider in the front and narrower in the back to carry that big neck, that big chest, that big shoulders, and big rack of horns. So we're looking for a good stride to the track, a big wide track. And, of course, drag marks in the snow and dew claws don't necessarily mean it's a buck.
Right.
So we're looking for a big, heavy track. And what I do, Larry, is when I decide to take a track, it, you know, I'll age the track, you know, because if I want to get on a track that's less than 4 hours old. So I will kneel down with the track right in front of me and I'll ball my fists up and I'll put it in the snow, put my fists in the snow on both sides of the track. And then I will compare the marks that I made with my fist to the track in between them. And if it's icy on the bottom or crusty around the edges, I know it's an older track. But if the marks I made with my fist, because the deer's hoofs put off heat just like my fist.
Right.
If the track is very similar to the marks I just made, I know it's less than 4 hours. And then I'll decide to get on it. And what I'll do then, Larry, is I'll cut a stick about the size of a pencil, and I'll put it in the top of the track at the widest point. And I'll break that stick off exactly the width of the track.
Yes.
And I'll put it in my pocket. Because when I get into a doe group where there's all kinds of tracks everywhere, I can take that stick out and I'll check. I don't go into the, what we call a barnyard where all the tracks are.
Right. Right.
I'll skirt the perimeter and on the high side, if possible, if there is no high side, I'll go the downwind side and I'll check every buck track leaving that barnyard and I'll kneel down and I'll drop that stick into that track to decipher my track from the rest of them.
That's pretty cool. I've tracked with African trackers, and some of those guys are, you know, really phenomenal. But they are using very much similar tactics, kind of what you do, I think.
Yeah, I'm
That's
sure
really
they do,
interesting.
Man. Yeah, it really is, and it you know, you can accomplish, you know, 20 minutes, half hour, and of course, you know, for every dominant buck, there's at least a half a dozen satellites, which can be from spikes to 10-pointers where I live. I killed a 10-pointer a few years ago that field dressed at 195, and I pulled a tooth out of it and had it aged, and it was, believe it or not, it was a year and a half old.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, you can accomplish in 20 minutes, half hour with that stick what could take you 3 to 4 to 5 hours with the naked eye trying to decipher which track you're on, you know. So that's a big help.
That's really interesting. So, yeah. Where I live here in Texas, I've got an opportunity where on a lease that I'm on where I do get to hunt quite a bit. And there, without a TV camera, finally, I actually get to hunt. And so I've been trying to be a little bit more like Randy Flannery all the time out there where I can get onto a deer and try to follow it. And I tell you what, to me, that is such a fun way of hunting. Now, you mentioned about knowing something about the size of the rack as well, too. Obviously, from the deer, the bigger buck can have a longer stride and a bigger foot, you know, and all those other kind of things. But what about, how do you get an idea? Well, I can see where you get some ideas on the weight as well, too, because the experience that you have taken deer and knowing kind of what size foot of, you know, bigger deer has, weight and all that kind of thing. But what about the antlers? How do you determine that?
Well, if you're not pushing a buck, okay, if you're not pushing him yet and he doesn't know you're on him, you know, they're not going to hit their horns on trees if they don't have to. So
right.
If you're tracking a buck and there's a two saplings or two trees side by side, and he goes around them, he just told you his rack is too big to go through there. another indicator on that in judging the size of the rack is if a buck stops to feed and he bends down in the snow to feed, whatever. There'll be tips. There'll be marks in the snow from the tips of his horns where he bent over to feed. So that's another good indicator on racks, you know.
Yeah, years ago I hunted moose up in Wyoming, the Shire's moose, and it was after a substantial snow, and that was one of the ways we knew, you know, that not only did we know, well, we knew it was a bull, but that was a pretty good indication as to how wide he was, because you could see where his antlers, you know, knocked off. Snow off of limbs or something like that, walking through that kind of thing. So I can see where that makes a whole lot of sense, by golly. Once you get onto a track, let's say, okay, you're onto the track, you see and you're after him, what will that deer do? I mean, he's naturally, until he knows you're there, he's just going to probably, meander around, or he's on a particular mission, mae going, as you mentioned, between doe groups or something like that. But at one point, you know, I grew up hunting hounds, and to me, what you were doing, we used to call that cold trailing until they, you know, jumped that animal. What are you looking for while you're cold trailing? And then once you realize that you got that animal, you know, he's aware that you're there or he knows something's going on. How do you change what you do during those times?
Well, that's a great point. And knowing when to go fast and when to go slow is paramount when you're on a track.
Right.
Because if you go too fast, as you know, you're going to just blow him out of there and he's going to line out. So what I'll do is I get on the track, and the first indicator, Larry, that a deer is wondering if he's being followed is what we call snow plowing. And my grandfather always called it snow plowing. And what it is the buck picks up his pace. He hasn't broken into a trot yet, or even a run. But he'll stretch right out and he'll pick up the pace and he'll start walking at a fast pace. And what he does is he's digging with his front feet because he's trying to cover ground faster, and he'll pull the snow back with his front feet. And that's the first indicator on the track that this buck is wondering if he's being followed or not. And at that point, I won't slow down yet, but I'll start to use my eyes more. And then when he starts to you know, when he starts to go to, like, stop at a blowdown, and then he'll go and he'll meander and he'll go over to another blowdown or go to a clump of evergreens, what he's telling you is he's looking to lay down. He's been up chasing the dove all night, and he wants to lay down. So at that point, you know, you got to slow down, and then, or if they stop to make a rub or scrape, you know they slow down.
Right.
So you got to slow down, you know. And if they start nipping browse or stopping to feed, you know, of course you got to slow down then as well. So anytime they slow down, you got to slow down. And then when you slow down, you start to use your eyes more. You're looking for the white throat patch, the white around their eyes, a flicker of an ear or a tail, a horizontal line in the woods, which would be their back, a leg, a horn. You're looking for a piece of a deer, not the whole deer, and you're always ready to shoot fast and with fast follow-up shots because the deer's on the move and you're on the move, so it's fast shooting. So that's pretty much what we do. And when they start to feed and wander like that, they're looking to J-hook to a high spot to check their back trail.
And that's something you know, so that's something you're going to be paying attention for, right?
I'm going to be absolutely paying attention to. And a lot of times in a situation like that, Larry, I'll break off the track, and I'll try to come in behind them from the high side and catch them laying there chewing their cud looking for me, you know? And I've taken a lot of pictures of bucks that I've passed on that I've walked in behind that were either standing there or laying down looking for me. And I was fortunate enough, the good Lord was looking after me. And I was fortunate enough to come up behind him. And if I wasn't going to shoot him, I'll snap a picture of him with my cell phone. My son Scott does the same thing.
Okay, now when y'all are you leave that track, how big a circle do you make? I mean, or a semicircle do you make? Do you go quite a way, or and I guess it kind of just depends upon what that animal's been doing, right? I mean, if he's looking like he's wanting to lay down, and that kind of thing would determine whether you make a big kind of semicircle or whether you make a short one.
Exactly, and the terrain has a lot to do with it as well. And,
yeah,
you know where we are. There's a lot of hills and mountains, and it's rolling, and there's giant cedar swamps where they live too. But you know that's what we do. And I'll make a real wide circle, what my grandfather called teardrop. You teardrop the track. If the tracks disappear, like if you're tracking a buck for several hours, and then all of a sudden the tracks totally disappear. You know, when I tell people in my seminars, we also got to keep in mind that only Santa Claus's deer can fly. The rest of them can't fly. so when the track disappears, Larry, I look to the side. On both sides of where I see the last track, and in every case, there's either a pile of jack fur or a blowdown or something. And what they'll do is they'll literally jump sideways 15, 20 feet, and you know how high they can jump.
Oh yeah.
And they'll jump to the side over an obstacle, and at that point, when the track disappears and they jump over an obstacle, you know they know you're after them. And in that case, I'll make a big wide circle, which like I said, my grandfather called it teardrop in the track. And I'll go out 300 yards to the high side if possible. If not the high side, I'll go on the downwind side. And I'll go out about 300 yards at a quick pace, and then I'll go forward parallel in the track by several hundred yards, you know, about, I'll go 4, 5, sometimes 600 yards at a fast pace, and then work my way back to the track, which is like making a big teardrop. And when I get back to the track, it's one of them things, one of them situations where you got to go at a quick pace, because every single time I've killed a buck that way, it's just when I'm getting back to the track is when I spot the buck. So it's like you come back to the track and he's right there. So it's like you no sooner get there and you're shooting at him. You know, that's just, if you do it right. If you do it right.
Exactly. When you get, now you mentioned hours sometimes. I know that you've probably gotten on a deer pretty quickly, kind of depends on, you know, as you mentioned, how trace that track was, what that deer was doing or all that. But normally when you get on a track, are you on them several hours or is it, you know, again, something that can happen, well, obviously can happen pretty quickly, but what's the longest you've tracked one in terms of hours?
Outdoor Life did an article on me several years ago called Randy
yes, sir?
Henry's Swamp Romp. They called it.
Right.
And I tracked that buck over three ridges through two cedar swamps. And I, when I ended up killing him, I was 5 1/4 miles from my truck. And I was on him all day. I from first light, I believe I shot him around 1/4 to 2 in the afternoon. And I was way, way too far to go back to the road. What I started on, so I ended up dragging that buck to a brook because to the northeast of me, there was a dirt logging road, a dead-end dirt logging road, and I ended up dragging him that way, but I didn't drag him out the whole way that day because it was already too late in the afternoon, so I left him along the brook, and then I got a compass reading. I put some flagging tape around them and I marked them. And I, to be honest with you, Larry, what we do up north is how I was taught. I take my shirt, my jacket, my shirt off, and I take my sweaty T-shirt and I pull it over mm-hmm. his head to keep the
yes,
critters
sir.
Away, you know?
And, yes,
and then I headed for the road and I was about a half hour, maybe a little bit longer, in the dark with my flashlight heading to the road. And then I walked the roads all the way back to my truck that night and went back in and got them the next day.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. that was quite an ordeal. But, I mean, I know it had to be satisfied. I've got to ask you a question. Do you ever leave your pickup without your compass or anything like that?
No, I carry three compasses. You know, the essentials, Larry, the essentials, what you should never enter the woods without, which can save your life, is three compasses, because if you carry three compasses and one breaks, which one's right? You know, if you carry two compasses and one breaks, which one's right? By having three,
yes.
You always have two compasses to read, you know what I mean? And I carry three compasses, three fire starters, a good knife, a good flashlight, extra batteries, and a topo map of the area I'm going into. Them are the essentials you should never enter the woods without. Now, I dress light because I'm always on the move. And besides that, I carry a space blanket. In case I got to spend the night in the woods, which thank God I never have, not on the track. But
right.
But I also, you know, I carry my gun, my cartridge belt, maybe a peanut butter and jelly sandwich in my pocket, and a bottle of water, and that's pretty much, you know, I dress light. You know, my grandfather always said when that first rush of cold air hits you, the two things are going to come to mind. One, you better get moving. Or two, you better put more clothes on, and you never want to put more clothes on. And if my mom or my grandmother ever knew how many sweaters I left in the woods that they needed me from getting overheated, they would have killed
yes,
me.
Sir. I can appreciate that. I'm the same way. I really dress light when I'm hunting, and now I'm finally getting to hunt again. Like I said, all those years we're doing television. There's two types of thing when it comes to hunting. There's hunting for television, and there's hunting, and the two don't really have a whole lot to do with each other when you get right down to it, as far as I was concerned. But you're right. I try to dress light, particularly if I'm going to do any kind of walking. If I know I'm going to walk a short distance and spend the day there sitting, that's one thing, and that's something that in some of these areas that I hunt, we, you know, we can do, and we get a lot of movement during the middle part of the day kind of thing. With,
oh, yeah.
But the interesting thing is I know that you use compasses and you have great, you know, confidence in them as well you should. Are you using any of the new GPS type things at all?
To be honest with you, Larry, I'm not going to say they're not a handy tool, but, you know, I just look at it this way, you know, not that I have anything against them, but although my grandfather used to say GPS stands for getting properly screwed up. but because, you know, if you're hunting, you know, you're well aware, just like I'm well aware of how Texas is, because I used to guide in Texas.
Oh, yeah.
I absolutely love the state of Texas. Matter of fact, I can't wait till May, because, you know, I was asked to speak again at the NRA convention, which is a great honor. And
oh, fantastic.
I can't wait to go back. You know, Sharon and I are looking forward to it so much. But you know, as you know, Maine is millions of acres of evergreens. So
yes, and they all look alike.
And they all look alike. And you better be good with your map and compass. And you know, like a lot of times, what I see with clients who have GPSs. Is if you're in the greens where Maine is mostly greens and the canopy's so thick, you can't even get a reading on the GPS. So I rely totally on the compass, and I've used it since I was a kid, as long as I can remember. So I think the compass is such a handy tool. And to be honest with you, and you know, when guides get together, a lot of us, especially Northwoods guides, you know, when we're talking about hunting and clients and stuff,
right.
we're amazed at the people who have hunted their whole life without ever learning how to use a compass. And what they fail to realize, the lion's share of them is if someone had taught them how to use a compass when they were young, they don't realize how much more success they would have had in their hunting life. If someone had taught them how to use a compass when they were young, because they get over that fear of getting lost. Because as you know, so many people today, they don't go more than 200 yards in off the road.
You're exactly right. When I was a kid growing up, my dad ran coon hounds, and we hunted a lot of times the same country. So we kind of knew, you know, landmarks, or you know this or whatever, even though we grew up in the woods kind of thing. But I learned how to use a compass, and it was mainly to, if my dad left me somewhere when I was a little kid, I could walk back to where the truck was, or at least walk to a road or something like that. You know, because a lot of times if the dogs took off, he would take off at a run after him, and he could run his legs were a lot longer than mine were back then. And so I'd be left out in the woods. Yeah. So it was kind of a forced situation. And then we used to run bear once in a while up in Wisconsin and get in some of these really dense thickets that were substantially of size, I guess I should say. And it was the same thing. Had we not had the compass, you know, we'd have roamed around out there for literally days sometimes, try to walk out some of those situations. And that's something very important. If somebody wants to hunt kind of like you do and they aspire to that, that would be a good starting point, would it not, where they were not familiar with how to use one?
Without a doubt. Without a doubt. It is so important that I'll tell you a quick story. When I was a little kid, you know, I don't know, maybe 11, 12, maybe 13, I can't remember, but my grandfather, we went bird hunting, because before my grandfather would teach anybody how to track and stalk, we had to spend a couple years bird hunting, because he said you first must learn how to hunt slow and react fast. And he
right.
took me bird hunting, and he literally hit on me for about 20 minutes, half hour, and let me have a good cry. And then he taught me how to use a compass, and he said, you know, until you feel that sense of hopelessness and helplessness, you'll never adhere to the compass like you should. Of course, I was so young at the time, I asked him what adhere meant.
I didn't know those compasses made sound.
Exactly. Exactly. And he made me promise that I did the same thing with my kids when I was teaching them, because he said that, you know, you got to scare them, get them good and scared, so they you know the value of how to use a compass and how to triangulate and find out where you are, and then and get out safely. So it's a, you know, knowing compass work is key. It is key to tracking this stuff, stalking, because like I said, you know, when you're in the thick canopy, and you know, we have cedar swamps up here in Maine that are gigantic. And,
yes, sir.
You know, you get in places like that, you know, there's many places you couldn't fall down if you wanted to. The trees are so tough, you know, and you're not getting a reading with the GPS and that stuff, you know?
No, you're not. Let's switch horses a little bit. Let's talk about the guns that you use.
Yep, my family has hunted with 16-inch barrel, iron-sighted Winchester lever guns for six generations.
Oh, my gracious. You know, so it's ever since I had a lever gun, right? Or probably even before.
You know, my grandfather hunted with a 16-inch barrel Trapper model. 38-55 was his favorite caliber, and 30-30 was his second favorite caliber, and you know, I have the same gun. So does my son, Scott. He's got a rack full of them, too. We have the same guns in just about every caliber that the Model 94 came in, from 22s to practice with, because my grandfather always said whatever you
right.
might deal with, have a 22 identical to it and burn the barrel right out of it practicing. You know, practicing shooting offhand, you know?
Yes, sir.
And I have Model 94s from 22 all the way up to 444, and I also have a Model 71 and 348, and I have an 1886 Trapper model in 4570. But I've shot more deer with the 30-30 than anything else, but I love all the calibers, and just like, you know, just like you and I've talked many times, there's no such thing as a bad caliber or a bad action. It's all how you intend to use it. And we have found for tracking and stalking that a short barrel lever gun, especially a Winchester, because you can shoot them faster than the rest of them, in
right.
my opinion, and they're easy to carry. They're easy to handle. They're fast. And we have found that the Trapper model Winchesters just work the best for us. And it's been that way forever. Matter of fact, my Uncle Art, he shot dozens upon dozens of giant bucks with an 1876 Winchester and 45-60.
Really? Yes. You know,
yeah. And what's amazing is his gun burned into the side of the stock was USC. And it was an old cavalry gun.
Yes, sir.
Shooting the horses out from underneath the Indians during the Indian Wars. And he shot dozens upon dozens of bucks. And he was quite the character. But he always said that I could count on one hand how many deer I ever shot at once. I can count on one hand how many deer I could tell you which bullet or bullets I hit them with, because I was always throwing five at them as fast as I could send them.
Exactly.
But that, you know, that's tracking and stalking, you know. I mean, you know, you gotta be able to have the ability to shoot fast and with fast follow-up shots, because you're on the move and the deer's on the move. So if you're trying to wait for that perfect shot, you're not going to go home with a deer.
So you're not carrying around one of those new Zam Zoomers that's got a 28-inch barrel and a scope that runs up to like 25 or 50 or whatever, and that'd be a good tool to have in the woods when you're hunting, isn't it?
You know, somebody would show up with a big old long barrel bolt action scoped rifle and my grandfather would say, look at that gun. He said the barrel's longer than last winter.
know, excuse me. I'm like, go ahead.
No, what I was just going to say is, you know, I have bolt action rifles, and I love them dearly.
I know, yes, sir.
You know, and I have some pump guns that I love dearly, but like, you know, the whole thing is I say in my seminar, having the right tool for the trade. I can't begin to tell you how many deer I have guided people with bolt action scope rifles. And again, I love them dearly, but I can't begin to tell you how many people I've guided who, number one, especially in the Maine woods, couldn't find it in the scope, and number two, couldn't work the bolt action fast enough for the second shot.
You're right, because most people I've found, whenever they work that bolt, they take their eye away from the scope to begin with, because they're concerned that bolt's going to hit themselves in the chin, you know, with their... And whenever you do that with a bolt action, you lose that sight picture. And, of course, with that lever action, you don't ever have to lose that sight picture.
No, you've got to – that's exactly right. And you stay right on the gun. And, matter of fact, one of the articles that Field & Stream wrote about me several years ago was how to train yourself to shoot a rifle like a shotgun. Never close one eye. Put the end of the barrel on the target and let the lead fly. You know, ignore the rear sight. Concentrate on the front sight. Matter of fact, some of my uncles and cousins, they took the rear sights right off of their Winchesters.
Really?
They totally concentrate on the front sight. Larry, I look right past the rear sight. I don't even pay attention to the rear sight at all. And matter of fact, on the newer, you know, when I say newer, over the last 25, 30 years, the rear sights on the Winchesters are literally on like a hinge. So I flop them right down. I flop them right down flat if I'm using one of the newer ones, and because I totally ignore the rear sight. I just, you know, concentrate on the front sight, and you know, it makes for faster shooting. And you know, basically that's what they teach combat soldiers in the military.
Right.
Concentrate on the front sight, and you know, you're gonna be better and faster on target.
That's really cool. I kind of forced myself when I shot open sights the last several years to do that, because I found that I could only concentrate on two of the three things. It was the back sight, the front sight, and the animal. The three different things. And out of those, if I wanted to shoot open sights, I had to concentrate on the front sight and the animal, because I couldn't see the back sight was totally blurred out, kind of thing. And so I guess without really realizing I was doing some kind of the same thing. Interesting.
Exactly. Because, you know, and Larry, most of the shots I get, you know, are well under 100 yards, and many of them are under 50 yards. You know, you're getting right up on them, and you know, that's just how it is. And a lot of people don't think you can walk up on a deer, even in noisy conditions. But on the stalking part of my seminar, I teach people how to walk in the woods and how to react to that buck when you jump him, whether he sees you first or not, so you can get yourself in a position to get a shot at him, if not immediately, within the next half hour, maybe an hour and a
half. Right.
You know, it is key. You know, and it's part of my grandfather's five basic principles of being a good deer hunter. And real quick, they are number one, be familiar with your map and compass so there's no fear of getting lost. Number two, learn how to pre-qualify the woods before you ever go into them, so you're not hunting in an area where there's no big bucks to begin with. Number three is learn how to walk in the woods under all conditions so you can walk up close enough to a deer to get a shot at them. And not jump them at 250 to 300 yards and never even hear them, never mind see them. Four is learn how to react to that buck when you jump him, whether he sees you first or not, so you can get yourself in a position to get a shot at him. If not, like I said, if not in a half hour, within an hour, hour and a half. And number five is learn how to shoot fast and with rapid fire and hit what you aim at. And them are my grandfather's five basic principles of being a good deer hunter. And that's, of course, tracking and stalking. But it's imperative, and if I tell people in my seminars, if you master those principles, you're going to be knocking down big bucks on a regular basis. Because there's many people who tell me there ain't a man alive. I've had many people. I was doing a seminar for Field and Stream up in Wisconsin a few years ago, and a gentleman came up to me after my seminar, says, I loved your seminar. I'm going to book a hunt with you. He says, I'm 64 or 63 years old. He says, I've been hunting Wisconsin, Minnesota, and the Upper Peninsula of Michigan my whole life. I've shot a lot of deer, but there ain't a man alive that can walk up on a deer in noisy conditions. And I said, okay. And it's funny because on the second day of the, he came up on a learn to track and stalk hunt, and on the second day of the hunt, we walked up. I was teaching him how to sound like a deer, walk up when there was no snow, and I'm teaching him how to walk up on a deer, and we walked up on a buck at 25 feet. And I got a picture. I got a picture in my seminar with me standing behind him. I took the picture with my phone, and there's the buck 20 feet in front of him, and not 20 yards, 20 feet. The buck is bedded, and I got a picture of him. And unfortunately, Larry, he had a scope on his gun, so when that buck catapulted out of that bed, in two bounds he was in the greens, and the guy couldn't find the deer in the scope, so he didn't shoot it. But I promise you, he will never say again that there ain't a man alive that can walk up on a deer in noisy conditions.
I love it. It's amazing. I go back to when I was a kid and how we hunted and how I hunted, and then all the years I spent doing TV, and it was totally different from everything. And again, now I love some of the old lever actions, and I had a Rossi 30-30 that I got this year and to play with. And I was able to, on our West Texas place, we have a lot of deer. That's one thing, but I was looking for one particular old buck that we were trying to get rid of. And that's basically just still hunting and found his tracks. Excuse me. I found his tracks a couple of times. He had a very unique track or kind of misformed hoof on his front right foot. So he was relatively easy to see, you know, where there was any kind of thing but solid rock. But, I was able to hunt that deer, and I was able to ended up shooting him at about, it was about 25 yards. But to me, that was so gratifying as opposed to, the other buck, that one other buck I shot out there, that he just walked out and shot him at long range, or long range to me is like 200-250 yards. And but that was such a fun hunt, and I'm finding myself doing that more and more again now, and I love doing it that way.
Oh, it's so much fun. And you know, when it comes to still hunting or stalking, as we call it, and there's really no difference, but Larry, I very rarely, when I'm stalking, have the wind in my face. I've shot just as many deer with the wind in my back as I ever have the wind in my face. Because when I'm following a track, I follow the track wherever it takes me. I pay no attention to the wind. I'm concentrating on the track and catching up to that deer.
Right.
But when I'm stalking, you know, if you, my grandfather always said, when people say, how do you keep killing these big bucks? And he always said, when the ground is soft from sun, rain, or snow, track, because you can see a track. If not,
yes,
and cross cut the wind and stalk. So that's pretty much what we do. And like I tell people in my seminars, if you're stalking through the woods and you got the wind in your face and you jump a buck, he's going to run 75 to 175, maybe 250, 275 yards at the most usually. And they're going to swing to the downwind side. So as people, because they want to smell you.
Yes.
So as you continue to walk through the woods looking for that buck that you jumped, before too long, he's going to be standing behind you watching you walk away from him. So I tell people in my seminars, if you pay real close attention and you listen real good, you'll hear the buck laughing at you. So you know, we cross cut the wind because we know that they're eventually, they may not start out downwind, but they're eventually going to go downwind because they want to smell you.
Exactly.
So as soon as I jumped a buck, now don't get me wrong, brother, if he jumps up in front of me and I got a shot,
you're going to shoot.
I'm going to shoot. I'm going to give it to him, you know, but if I don't get a shot, because I'm cross cutting the wind, I'm not going to run right with the wind, but I'm going to run on a 45 degree angle,
mm-hmm.
100, maybe 125 yards. And I'm going to drop to one knee. I'll take a deep breath, drop to one knee, and I'll kneel down right there on one knee waiting for him. And I'll wait 20 minutes, half hour. I'll wait 20 minutes, half hour, and you'll see them. You'll hear them first. You know, you'll hear,
mm-hmm.
you'll hear that buck. And when you see him, he's going to be looking over the way you jumped him, and you're off to the side waiting for him, and he has no idea you're there. Because when he was running, you were running. So he can't hear you run while he's running. it's a great way to outfox him, or if you will, you know?
Absolutely. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
What I was going to say is when you're talking about how they will turn around and, you know, if they know somebody behind, they'll kind of J-hook kind of back. I have shot numerous deer by letting somebody get on just walk. I mean, maybe we're just walking through, you know, likely looking spot of deer and let them get out there about 100 yards ahead of me and then follow along very slowly. And I have shot a lot of bucks where they turned around, you know, where they made a circle, kind of came around to catch that individual's wind kind of thing. And that's a great way to do it. If you got somebody you can trust, you know, to hunt with where you got two people working like that.
It's a great way, and what you just explained, we do all the time. Like my son and I, when we're hunting together, that's a great tactic. And what I'll do, Larry, is I'll wait 20 minutes, half hour, and if he doesn't show up after I run downwind, I'll wait 20 mm-hmm. minutes, half hour, and if he doesn't show up, Will Primos, who I know you know, Will, he's a great guy.
Oh, absolutely.
He gave me one of his hands-free calls. It's real small that I keep around my neck, and I'll wait 20 minutes, half hour, and if he doesn't show up, then I keep that call on doe grunt, because my grandfather always said empires have been lost over females. You'll call more you'll call more deer back to you when you jump them with a doe call than you will a grunt call. Not that a grunt call don't work, and you know, they work phenomenal. But I'll whack that doe call twice, and then I'll wait another 20 minutes, half hour, and if they don't show up, then I'll get up right there where I stopped, and I'll resume my stalk at a slow pace, looking for a piece of a deer ready to shoot fast and with fast follow-up shots. Because I know the deer's right out in front of me. And I've shot many deer that I've literally jumped up and ran downwind on two or three times on the same buck on the same day and ended up killing them because just using that same tactic. And it really works, you know, but many times I don't have to even go to the call. I'll just run downwind and they'll J-hook around looking over to where I jumped them, and I'm off to the side waiting on them, and they don't even know I'm off to the side. Another thing to keep in mind is if you jump that same scenario, if you're stalking through the woods and you jump that buck and he blows at you,
right.
He's telling you he either winded you, saw you, or you at least made him nervous. When that happens, Larry, I run right at him. I'll run right at him, and I'll run, this time you're going to run a little longer. I'll run 125, 135, 150 yards sometimes. And what you do is you'll catch them when they're starting to make their swing. Usually the shots may be the shots may be a little bit longer, you know, 75, 100, 125 yards, not usually more than 100, but you'll get them when they start to make their swing. So, you know, that's another, you got to be able to adapt when you're, you know, when you jump them and run right at them when they blow at you. They're going to run farther. So you got to run a little bit farther. And at that point, like I said, I run right at them.
Let me ask you a question. Let's say you're out and you're on a track and you jump there's a doe out there somewhere. She starts snorting at you and you can pretty well tell the difference. What do you do? How do you react to that?
Well, you know, most people don't realize that a mature doe is probably the smartest animal in the woods.
Yes, sir.
And you know, when you have that happen, you know, what I do is I'll usually just, if I know it's a doe, I'll just resume my stalk. I'll just keep doing what I'm doing. Of course, I won't move right away because I'm picking the woods apart with my eyes to see if there's a buck near it.
Exactly, you know? Right.
And then I try my best to, it's hard, of course, but I try my best to just resume my stalk, and I'm going at a slow pace, and I'm trying my best to sound like a deer. Which doing that, Larry, is, you know, when it's quiet, I try to be quiet. When it isn't quiet,
right.
I don't try to be quiet because all you do is sound like a man trying to be quiet. So
exactly.
Yeah, I shorten my steps. And I bury my toes because, you know, they have four legs, we have two. I shorten my steps, I bury my toes, and I'll go three steps real quick. So it sounds like a deer.
Right.
And when you do that, they will hold it because they think you're a deer. And we've walked up on dozens and dozens and dozens of deer in noisy conditions sounding like a deer. And it really, really works. Matter of fact, one time, my son Scott, who's 225, I'm 250, and Dick Bernier, God rest his soul, he was with us, and he was about 190, and the three of us are stalking through the woods in noisy conditions, and we're about 50 yards apart, and we all walked up within 35 yards of a bedded buck who was looking at me when my son took the picture of him with his cell phone, but there's three grown men walking 50 yards apart in very noisy conditions who all walked up within 35 yards of that buck because he thought we were deer. And you know, people don't think you can do that, but you can actually do that if you sound like a deer and you're cross cutting the wind.
That is so interesting. Some of that, as you're talking, some of those things kind of came back to me on different times when I was walking, you know, like I said, particularly here as of late where I don't have a TV camera guy on my shoulder making more noise and, you know, I heard a buffalo coming behind you kind of thing. And
boy, don't I know that.
Yeah, I know you do. With all due respect to all the camera guys that I've ever worked with, I mean, there were some that were hunters and they understood. And then there were others that understood cameras and they had no concept that animals could smell, hear, see, or anything else kind of thing. So,
but exactly.
It's amazing as you're talking, as I did recall different experiences, you know, from, like I said, years and years ago when I was a kid. And then more recently when I really started hunting again, instead of being a shooter, going back to being a hunter kind of thing. Randy, initially, my thoughts were, is when I got you on the phone, is I wanted to talk to you about fall bear hunting and a whole lot of other things. What I'd like to do, if it's okay with you, is I'd like to get back with you in a couple of weeks or so when you get off the speaking tour. Unfortunately, I am not going to be at the NRA show this year. I got an opportunity to go hunt bear again up in Alberta, and I love bear hunting, so I'm going to probably miss NRA. So I'm sorry I'm going to miss your seminar and miss your presence there, but I'd love to get back with you, and let's sit down And let's talk a little bit about fall bear hunting and maybe even a little bit of fishing, because you got some of the finest fishing in the world up there, and you guys have some absolutely fantastic bear hunting there, particularly in the fall as well, too. So is that something we might be able to do?
I'd love to do that. And we guide a lot of moose hunters as well. And, you know, I tell people guiding moose hunters is like turkey hunting on steroids. You know, I love to do all that, you know.
Let's do that. We'll do that as a separate one, too, because back in 95, I shot a moose in Maine, and it was with a TC Encore. At the time, we didn't even know what they were going to call the thing. And over the years afterwards, I went up there several times when I was working with Thompson Center and, you know, helped with both bear hunts and moose hunts up there. So I'd love to come back. You've got, I know, a very busy, you're very busy during the fall, of course, hunting, all that kind of thing, and guiding, and then you do a tremendous amount of seminar speaking. And you're such a great speaker, and you've got such great stories and great knowledge based upon experience, not just theory kind of thing like you hear from a lot of other people. But if somebody were to try to get in touch with you to try to have you come be a speaker, or, you know, they're interested in your operation and what do you call your hunting lodge area there?
It's Wilderness Escape Outfitters.
Wilderness Estate Outfitters. How can they get in touch with Wilderness Estate Outfitters, and how can they get in touch with you to see about getting you to come do a seminar or just to learn more?
Sure. Wilderness Escape Outfitters is in northeast Maine. We're only 15 miles from the New Brunswick, Canada. We live on a lake. We have a mile of lake frontage. We lease over 500 square miles of woods. They can go to our website, which is wildernessescape.com, or they can call our home phone. The lodge number is 207-448-3238. And my wife Sharon, who you know, she's the brains and the brawn of the operation.
And also the best cookie baker I've ever run into, by the way. So please tell that beautiful lady I said hello, and I can't wait to have to get somewhere where she's having some cookies again.
Yeah, I think I'll keep her, Larry.
You better. Randy, tell everybody who's listening the phone number one more time, and we'll try to get in show notes and all that other kind of thing too. But just one more time, what is the lodge number, or how's the best way to get in touch with you? What that phone number that you gave just a few moments ago?
Yes, sir. It's 207-448-3238.
Okay, 207-448-3238.
Yep, Wilderness Escape Outfitters.
Wilderness Escape Outfitters. Randy, thank you so very much for joining us here around the DC campfire today. I can't wait to get back in touch with you. We'll do this again before too very long. One of these times too, I want to hear about some of the individual bucks that you've taken, what you had to go through to get those. Cause I know some of those, like that one you're talking about that was written about years ago, that had to be an experience of a lifetime when you get right down to it, to not only have the stamina, but also to have the patience to stay on a buck that long. So I can't wait to hear some more stories from you.
Well, we appreciate you, Larry, and please give my best to Mary Ann and Beth and your whole wonderful family. Anytime we can get together, my friend, is a blessing, and I appreciate you so much.
Well, we're going to look for some more opportunities this time we got back together again. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank y'all so very much for joining this morning around the DSC campfire. Look forward to having you right back here again next week. Randy Flannery, thank you so very much for being with us.
Larry, thank you, my friend. God bless you and your family.
DSC's Campfires has also been brought to you by the Crown Bar in LaGrange, Texas. Habit, our gear, your adventure. The Texas Wildlife Association. Double Nickel Taxidermy, Burnham Brothers Game Calls, and H3 Whitetail Solutions.
You'd think, with four of us spread out on a tiny island, that the task of tagging a whitetail would not be a big thing. But, as I've learned, no matter where I've been, whitetails can be damn tricky.
Pursuing wild game in wild places. Tune in to Hunt Stand Presents Saturdays at 8:30 p.m. Eastern. Waypoint TV, the destination for outdoor entertainment.
You want to succeed. You want to fish. You want to be one of the greatest.
Tune in to West Marine's Life on the Water, presented by Costa Custom Boats, every Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV.